Hello, this is John Hildreth. You're listening to Improv Nerd with Jimmy Crane.
That's improv, bitch. Improv, bitch.
I mean, after all, you're nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Hi, I'm Jimmy Crane, and welcome to another episode of Improv Nerd. Today's guest is well-known Second City teacher, director, and actor John Hildreth. John talked about his long and storied career as a teacher and director at Second City.
How does that make you feel?
That makes me feel good.
Yeah. Okay, we were trading some emails. And first thing you said was, in one of your emails, your wife gave you some advice about doing the show tonight. What was that
right.
advice?
She gave me some talk show advice. She said to be myself. And she said to, these are her exact words, answer the goddamn questions.
Now, let me, because you do, if people haven't seen you perform here or you do characters. I mean, you really get lost in the character. Is it hard for you to be yourself?
I don't think so. I think that nowadays, especially, that I've gotten older and kind of lazier with character work, all my characters are kind of myself. It's like, you'd be like, hey, Grandma. And I'd be like, hey, what's up? I'd be like, Father O'Shaughnessy. I'd be like, hey, what's up? And it's, I guess I'm, I never thought I was good at funny character voices and accents and all that sort of stuff. So I don't mess around too much with that. That's like my my discomfort zone. And what I try to do is behave a different way. You know, at the very base, this character is me. This is me if I were a teen mom. Or this is me if I were whatever, the king, or whatever the scene calls for.
But even when you did more of a what you probably would think of a developed or a three-dimensional character, isn't there an essence really of you in that character?
Yeah, most definitely. It's like you take a certain part of yourself, of your personality, and heighten it. Like, take one little part, usually, and just blow it all out of proportion.
Now, you also said to me you were going to be, in the email, a handful. You
yeah.
wanted to be a handful. what does that look like for you?
I just wanted to scare you a little bit.
Okay. Now, how were you going to do that?
I don't know. Obviously, it didn't work.
All right. Growing up, your dad... It's not too late. You can still scare me.
Okay.
You're very intense. That kind of scares me. And there's a very, like, professorial quality to you that intimidates me.
I look intense.
Yes.
But I'm not really intense. I don't think so.
Where does that come from? I mean, are you hiding behind the being intense?
No. It's just, like, my face, normally, if I'm relaxed, it's like this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just very, apparently, a very intense, intimidating thing. And I'm just relaxing here. It like takes effort to smile and be all fakey. And it's like, I'm just not going through the effort. I'm just relaxing here. Relax my face. And people interpret that, oh, he's not smiling. He's intense.
Mm-hmm. Okay, growing up, your dad worked at JCPenney. You're smiling now. Is that a real smile or a fake
yeah.
smile? Okay.
I'm being myself.
Okay. It almost sounds like an exercise.
Oh.
I'm being myself. Your dad worked at JCPenney stores, right?
Right.
And he opened up new stores. Is that right?
He was a store manager. And every 2 or 3 years, he would get moved to a slightly bigger store. You know.
So I would imagine that you were like the new kid every
Always.
Couple of years. What was
Always.
That like?
You learn certain things about human nature, being always being the new kid, and always being like, you know, here's an honest moment, Jimmy.
Okay.
This is your one honest moment tonight. Being the one black kid, that's, I'm very used to that. And you get a certain vantage of people and the types of people that are in groups. For example, these were all small towns in the Midwest that my family lived in, and there'd only be one black family. And all the kids in school will have had like absolutely no exposure to black people outside of, you know, like Jimmy Walker on TV or something
right.
like that. So they don't really know what to do. So I learned that the first kids to approach you and try to be your friends were the, we used to call them burnouts.
Okay, the smokers.
The smokers. Someone that smoked back in those days was automatically a burnout.
Right.
But yeah, the bullies and the burnouts that thought, oh, just because it's a black kid, he's going to be one of us and he's going to be... So you learn to like, okay, boom. Like, not going to be friends, not going to do that, not going to do that thing.
Did that help you? Because when we started out, I said we both kind of started at the same time. There was no black people doing improvisation.
Yep.
And so, now that scared me. I'm like, oh, maybe I, you know. So going into, I mean, being the only black person in a white community, was that easier for you because that's how you were raised when you came into improv? It was like, well, I'm the only black guy here.
I think it's definitely what I'm used to. So it was easier that way. But, you know, I don't think, well, I definitely know that I don't sound typically black or urban because I wasn't raised in, you know, the inner city or in that, whatever, environment, culture. And I don't think, I don't think it was a huge issue to me. I wasn't really aware, really, that, okay, I'm the only black dude. It was just, right. It's another show, another group, another class.
But your work, to me, was like, it wasn't black, it wasn't white. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah.
And where do you think that came from?
I just think it was my sense of humor. I don't think it was black. I don't think it's white. And I think I really think you have to go with your sense of humor.
What would you say your sense of humor is?
Okay, wow. Jimmy, I'm going to be honest.
Okay.
I couldn't describe my sense of humor. Whole bunch of things make me laugh. Some stuff is like dumb stuff. Like, I love the Three Stooges.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, so I guess I'm not an intellectual.
But you went to the University of Chicago and you were going to be a doctor. How did you get interested in science?
I was just always interested in science all through school. I was really good. I was a very good student all through high school, through grade school. My mother was a teacher, so school was important.
And so you go to University of Chicago, you're a chemistry major, you actually take the test to become a doctor.
I was totally pre-med.
And then all of a sudden, sophomore year, what happens?
Well, I'm going to back up a little bit.
Okay.
When I first get there, I had also... done theater all through grade school, high school. I also played and sang in choir, all that stuff. But when I got to college, I found out that, okay, I'm not going to have enough time with my studies to do both theater and music, so I decided to drop music.
Mm-hmm.
Totally dropped music. And at that time, there was no theater department at the University of Chicago. And so it's anyone could put up any show they wanted. All they needed was a faculty sponsor, just someone to sign a piece of paper. And you just go rehearse it, do whatever the hell you wanted. And that sounded like a blast. So I did some theater. And then I got into an improv group.
And then from there, how did you get into Carter Giants?
That improv group performed once a week at Jimmy's Woodlawn Tap. And there were four original members of that group, and I was in the next wave. It's just the same guy that ran that group, Avant Garfield, he ran the improv groups every year. There was a new group that he added. Cardiff Giant was the name that group used, Avant Garfield, when we did shows on the North Side.
Why'd you switch names?
Because, you know, Garfield was a South Side street, mm-hmm. and, you know, we wanted a cool name for our group, you know? They'd be like, Avant Garfield, that's a plant, you know, we didn't think it would play.
So that group was groundbreaking in terms of improvisation.
Can you? I think it was.
Okay. So tell us, go back to the late 80s, early 90s, when you guys were around, what the scene was like in Chicago in terms of improvisation, and what made you guys groundbreaking? Because I remember those times very romantically. I mean, in terms of, I was doing Jazz Freddy, you guys were, you know, another group.
I remember seeing Jazz Freddy,
mm-hmm.
and being, wow, blown away by it. Because it was, we used improvisation to write plays. And our final product was a play.
Which nobody was doing at the time.
Nobody was doing at the time.
And what was it like back in, I mean, it almost, when I look back at it now, it was almost like the Wild West, or there wasn't as many opportunities to perform. What did you think of it back then in the 80s and in the 90s?
I agree. I mean, compared to now, there weren't as many places and opportunities to receive instruction. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that? I almost get like there wasn't good teachers back then, or
no,
there are better teachers now.
It's just there are more teachers now. There are more places offering improv classes. Back then, I don't even know if, I might be wrong. I'm not sure I.O. had a training center. I know that we had a couple sessions with Sharna when we competed,
uh-huh.
and I'll tell you about those maybe some other time.
Well, don't tease us. Tell us a little. Just a little.
Maybe in a second.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I meant. It's not that the teachers are better. Maybe they are. Maybe they were. I'm not saying anything about that. It's just more opportunities. Here, everyone's got classes going. Nowadays, there are so many more opportunities to perform mm-hmm. improv. It's just about every bar on the North Side has a night where they clear out the back room, and you and your buddies can get your improv group and get some performance going.
Do you think that is a good thing or a bad thing? And I'll tell you why. Let me just say, could of a Carter Giants come out of 2012 today in the improv community?
I think so. I think just because nobody is doing that now. I mean, I saw an excellent improvised play with that group, Almost Atlanta, a few weeks ago. It was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But we wrote a play and we performed that play. It wasn't an improvised play. So I don't think anybody else really is doing what we did, and nobody else had our quirky, satirical sense of humor and our ridiculous characters. And I think that's an open space that someone needs to fill up.
And then Greg Hallman and Greg Kotis.
Greg Kotis, Mark Hallman.
Mark Hallman. They ended up writing You're in Town, and they were part of the group. Scott Hermes, Bob Fisher, Laura Fisher. I mean, it was a powerhouse group. You were in it. What happened? How did it break up?
Bob and I came to Second City, and Greg and Scott went to the Neo Futurists, and that was pretty much it. Greg went to the Neo Futurists too.
And then you come to Second City, and you do your first you tour for a while, right?
Yep.
And then you do your first review at Northwest.
Right.
Casino Evil.
Right.
And you told me that was, and you do five after that, but that was your favorite.
I'll tell you that was the best Second City review ever. Just ask anyone in that cast.
What was it that was so much fun about that show?
I think what was really great about it was that no one in that cast had ever done a Second City review before. This was everyone's first show.
And you had Scott Adsit in that, who goes on to 30 Rock, right. And Nia Vardalos.
Vardalos, right.
Uh-huh. And who else was in it?
Aaron
Rhodes.
Myself, Jim Zulovic.
Uh-huh.
And Aliza Marietta.
Okay.
And Mark Levinson.
Was the musical
John
director.
And Holtzen.
Okay.
Everyone was new, and we had Norm, who was just perfect for that group.
Norm Holly, who
yep.
teaches here and is also director.
Yep. And it just clicked. We were wild and crazy, and we had a lot of fun stuff in that show, and wow.
What was Nia Vardalos like in those days?
Very funny, very talented. Very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was, I believe, I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but she had been in a cast or two up in Canada.
Yes.
And she was coming down here, and I think it was her first show mm-hmm. down here. And I toured with her for a while.
And she kind of had, as I remember, a rough go. Because in those days, if you came down from Canada, I get the sense you didn't get, there's so much politics in Second City. Did you not, I would guess that you wouldn't get involved in it.
I'm going to say I noticed it.
Okay.
But I'm going to say nothing else about it.
Okay. When she came here, there was, And Mike Myers had that same problem. When people came from Canada down here, there was kind of a resentment that they bumped, you know, they went ahead in the line.
There was all that kind of stuff going on then, because it was, you know, the understanding was you go from Northwest to ETC to Main Stage, and you move up that way, and there are people ahead of you, and when one of them moves on, you think they're going to, you know, seniority. That was how it was almost kind of understood.
Mm-hmm.
But then stuff stopped happening like that. And there are people from I.O. coming in. It's like, what? Where? I was like, what? And, you know, people doing the jump right to Main Stage. Unheard of in those days.
Now, here's this is what I remember. You do three reviews at ETC. There was something going on back at ETC. I don't remember. There was something with cast members. And then, this is a rumor, so if you can clarify it for me, that you were offered Main Stage, and you said, no, I'm not interested.
That is not true.
Okay. Not at all?
No. I was not offered Main Stage.
Is that something you regret?
I think I would have liked to have done a show at least on Main Stage, even though I'm super proud of the work I did and the people I worked with.
And you would have liked to have just had that opportunity.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, I'm going to push you here. Why don't you think that happened? I mean, you had a great reputation.
I don't know why it didn't happen.
Okay.
I honestly don't know.
Do you think that... were you one who played politics at all?
No, I wasn't. And I don't think... I think that that distinction between main stage and ETC is much bigger, was much bigger back then than it is now. Now, you know, it's like a resident company.
Well, what's
good for you?
Why has that changed in the last 10 years or so?
I don't know.
You know what I think? I think because because people have. It's a fame thing. People have, you think of Jack McBrayer, you think of, there's a lot of people that have made it from the ETC and also have made it to go on. But also there's times where that was kind of like the stepchild of the of Second City. And there's times where those shows are better than what's on the main stage. And I think they've traded back and forth.
I think you might have something there.
All right. Is this uncomfortable for you? Did you expect these kind of questions?
Maybe, yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, I don't want to... I feel like I've already run off a couple times not being fully knowledgeable about stuff. So that's what makes me feel a little uncomfortable. I'm just going by what I think my impressions are of what's going on.
Okay. All right, why don't we improvise? Would you be more comfortable improvising?
Probably not.
Okay. What makes you uncomfortable about improvising?
I think being a little uncomfortable is a good thing.
Okay.
About it. Being a little bit nervous, being a little bit, uh-oh. I think that's a good sign.
And when was the last time you improvised?
You know, I improvised with some students earlier today.
In class or?
In class.
Okay.
I made a point of it.
When is it okay for a teacher to jump in and improvise with the students and not lose control of the class?
I started doing it several years ago when I demonstrate a game or an exercise. I explain the exercise, and then it's like I usually know who would be a good person to help me with this, or a couple good ones. I call those students up, and I have them demonstrate, and we play that exercise just for a little while.
Okay.
And I've been doing that for a long time. I think it's effective.
You don't think it's like sometimes I'm lazy, so I just... I'm like, unless it's a small class, I'm not going to get in there, you know, because I feel, I don't know, I feel like it's their time.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. But I think people are kind of, or they can be, students can be like a little bit scared to do some stuff. Or not understand what you're talking about. And so if I could take a minute or two and show them an example of how this is supposed to work.
So you're not doing like a 30-minute montage
no.
with them? Okay.
No, I don't even complete the exercise. I usually interrupt it and I say, et cetera, or does anybody have any questions?
Okay. All right, so we're going to improvise.
Great.
I'm always nervous. I'm always nervous.
I'm going to be slightly more nervous than you.
Okay.
That's my goal. Just stay slightly more nervous than you.
Okay, and here's something I want to throw out because my girlfriend comes to the show. Does your wife come to the show and give you notes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
She's noticed that I always play low-status characters. How would I break something like that?
I just was messing around with status with my level C class last night. And yeah, people gravitate, I think, in the characters that they play towards the status that they like to take in real life, yeah, I think.
I agree with you.
And, you know, you need to just have that person play high status. Explain to them what high status characters can do, what are the options that a high status character has to move a scene forward and to make something scenic, and how a high status character can drop in status and you can reverse the status and you can just keep messing around with that. You just give them a status game to play and a couple ideas of what to do.
Okay, so going forward into this, what would you give me?
Oh, I wouldn't dare give you some notes.
Really?
Or give you advice.
Are you serious? Because I think this is something that I've always struggled with, because you're absolutely right. I look at myself as low status in life, and that's what I bring onto the stage.
Here's what we'll try then. I'm going to try to be lower status than you.
Okay.
I know that you're also a slow improviser.
Yes.
I'm going to try to be slower than you. Slower, lower, and worrieder.
Okay. All right. We are going to improvise, Carrie. We need a location.
Cave.
A cave. I cleared it out and I put them right here.
Okay.
So later, when we need them, they're going to be right here. I marked them here.
Good.
Okay, I wrote on the wall right there, kindling, and then an arrow, so you'll know exactly where it is.
I appreciate that.
No problem.
You're going to make this just like home. I need some kindling now.
Okay. Well, okay, you got to sign that out.
All right.
Great. Here. There you go. Just right on the wall there. How long are you going to use it for?
I'm just going to sign this and give it right back to you.
Great, I appreciate it.
Amazing. You can remember your pen, but you can't remember your cigarette lighter.
Maybe I lost my cigarette lighter on purpose, so you could find it later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe I've already found it.
Okay, that's a funny little game. Why don't you give it to me? Nate, why don't you just give me the lighter there?
You know what? I don't think so, Rick. This is a personal fire. You've heard like a personal pizza.
Yeah. That's actually going to be on the menu for Tuesday. I wrote that on the wall. We're going to have pizza on Tuesday. We're going to have a cold pizza if I don't have that lighter.
I'm not going to make it until Tuesday. I'm not going to make it.
Well, you are just a crab.
I'm not an outdoor person. I like it indoors. I like sounds I'm accustomed to. I'm going to be a grump when I'm in an environment that isn't working for me.
Well, we're down here for 4 days, okay?
I'm not going to make it.
Well, that attitude, of course you're not going to make it. It's all psychological. It's like the POW, when they're in a POW camp. What would you do right now, Nate, if you were in a POW camp?
Do you know that some people don't make it through POW camps?
Why do you have to be so negative, okay?
Look,
I'm talking about the 10% that do survive.
Here's what's really, really bothering me.
Okay.
That I think you've already planned for me not surviving. And I'll bet there's a plot with my name written on it already where you're going to bury me. Tell me I'm wrong.
I am going to kill you.
You're going to kill me?
That's why I got you out here. I knew you weren't going to survive, and if I killed you, then it's going to look like you died of natural causes.
How are you going to kill me? That's what I want to know.
Well, there's a million ways I can kill you in this cave. Rocks falling down by accident. It looks like an accident. I take this ship out.
Whoa!
And when you're sleeping, I cut your throat. And I take this lighter.
Fuck you. Fuck you.
Those are just two ways.
Okay, Mr. Ways. I'm gonna kill myself. I'm gonna kill myself and make it look like not an accident. It's gonna look like you killed me. You're gonna get the blame for killing me and none of the pleasure of doing it.
You wouldn't dare do that. You're just saying that. Because you know what? When you cut your finger, you're the biggest little baby. So, here, go ahead, kill yourself. I'll help you kill yourself.
Not killing myself. I'll take the lighter back.
Oh, really? What are you going to do with it?
Going to start another two-person fire.
Oh, two-person
fire. Two-person fire.
Oh. All you got to do is sign it out. If no one else has signed it out, you can have it. Looks like 4:30 to 5 is open. It'd be a good time to take out the lighter.
Oh, Jesus.
Here. It's my pen. Boy, you are jumpy.
Yeah, I am jumpy. There's going to be no more labeling things. There's going to be no more signing out things. Right? There goes half of your power. Right?
I've got a ship. Okay. I've got the lighter. You have a pen. You're going to break the pen.
Don't break the pen. I'm going to break the pen.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Put down the ship.
Putting it down.
Put it down. Back away from the ship.
Backing away. If you break that, that's the end of civilization in this cave, as we know.
I'm a little sick of civilization in this cave.
Well, just don't break it, all right? I put the ship down. Now just...
Right. The lighter go.
Really?
Yeah. The lighter down.
I don't know. There.
Back away from the lighter.
You're nuts.
Yeah. You're responsible. Oh, look at me. Look at all the stuff I've collected.
This is hilarious. You are hilarious. You know how pathetic you look?
You know, you're the only one here.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
I'm going to take this sign up sheet. What?
You don't care about order at all, do you?
Order has no place in this cave. Order is getting in the way.
What are you doing? I've done everything you've asked me. Now just don't break the pen, please.
I'm not going to break the pen.
Okay.
I was never going to break the pen.
What did you put me through all that for?
I'm going to break the pen.
That was a lot of fun.
That was fun. You were kooky.
I was kooky?
Kooky, good. Good kooky.
Okay. I was thinking about something when I was doing that scene, which probably isn't a good thing. But I was thinking of you guys at Carter Giants, that you always would kill somebody at the end.
Always.
What was that? If we were going to take something from life, you know, like, because I really believe that, like you said, you bring your low, you know, if you feel like your low status in life, you bring it on stage. What was that about wanting to always kill somebody on stage? You all wanted to.
I think it just was to us the most ridiculous conclusion to all. To all of our stories. They all centered around like real small, almost like politics going on between like nobody characters, a lot of the time anyway, and just heightening it and ramping it up to death, you know, so they you can't beat up on that person anymore, you know.
The other thing you guys did was you always heighten the stakes, and I see today improvisers don't heighten the stakes as much. Do you think that's true?
I cannot say that is true.
Okay.
I still see improvisers. There are some improvisers that always know how to move a scene forward. And it's just a knack. What a great knack to have, being able to go into a situation and immediately just heighten it. So I still see people that play like that, and they still get on teams.
All right, we're gonna see if the audience has got some questions for you, either
right.
What we just did or about John. So if we could turn the lights up, Carrie, got some questions for us. So just put your hands up, and if you have a question to ask John, yes.
I'm just wondering if do you still get pre-show jitters or you know a little adrenaline?
Always.
Always.
And like I was kind of saying, that's to me that's a good sign. I think there are people that don't get nervous, and there's something wrong with those people. There's something wrong.
Great, thank you.
Well, did you ever find yourself getting in a rut? And if you do, you have anything that like gets you out of it?
Yeah, I get in a rut, I think. I like to see a lot of improv and get inspired by how other people play and what they do. And sometimes that'll help me come from a new angle. Or a lot of times in class, you know, just being around improv a lot and people that are doing it, you can always see something and shake an old idea out.
Yes.
If there was like some advice you could give yourself when you were younger, like first starting out in improv, what advice would you give yourself?
I would say keep doing what you do, and I would say I think that's the biggest thing I would say. Keep doing what you do.
When you mean keep doing what you do, keep improvising or keep what's working for you?
Keep and hang on to what is making you different.
Mm-hmm. How do people do that if they don't, you know, certainly starting out, they don't have that perception?
You know, yeah. I agree. I think every group that's coming together, every performer has something, at least one thing that makes him or her or them different. They might not know what it is. That's mm-hmm. what you're saying.
Yes.
You got to find out what it is, and you need some help, maybe.
Through a teacher, a director,
yeah,
your cast
get
member?
Get a coach. Get an outside eye that's going to see what it is that you're doing different, and it's going to encourage you to keep doing that. And
do you ever? Because I'm struggling with this now. It's like I'm just like, what is it that I do? You know?
I struggle with that. You know, you ask me, what is your sense of humor? I was like, I don't know. How can I describe it? How can I describe what it is I do? When it seems to me like, every once in a while, I completely change what it is I
right.
do. It seems like I get a new vantage on it, you know.
Do you ever go periods of time where it's like, God, I'm just not funny. I don't even want to be funny. I'm just not funny.
Yeah. I'm like, oh, wow. What was... Yeah. That happens.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. At this point in your career, what's your next big goal? Or is it just kind of all a journey?
That's for you.
This point in my career.
Yes.
Do
you not see yourself as a career? Why did you...
I don't think. Okay. I was making a point more of this point.
Right.
Yeah. I think I'm gradually coming around to understand that, oh, shit, this is my career. This has been my career. Because, you know, when your schedule changes every 8 weeks and every semester, you're teaching a different class and, you know, you're meeting 50 new people. Everybody's like, it doesn't really seem like it's a career, like you're a businessman or something.
But in all fairness, when we started out, if you would have said to somebody back in 1992 or something, you're going to make most of your living teaching improv, people would have said... No way, because there wasn't. Yeah. There was like five teachers.
Exactly.
You know? Exactly.
I would say that maybe a couple few years ago, I realized that my career was all teaching and all directing and all coaching, and doing that kind of stuff makes me want to perform more and more. It's just the more you coach, the more you direct, the more you teach, there's the more you gotta improvise. And I was like promising myself, I'm going to improvise. And I finally did it this year with Jam Sandwich. It's like, you know, for the last 3 years, it's like, this is the year of the performer. It's like, nope. This is the year of the, nope. So this is the year of the performer. And so I'm finally getting back out there, which is my goal to, Jimmy, we had plans to do a
yes,
show, didn't we?
Yes, we did. How can we make that happen?
You, such the mogul
yeah.
in this business with your career and
yeah.
all,
yeah.
you could make a phone call and you could make that happen.
Because mm-hmm. I really enjoyed playing with you because you're
yeah.
really, Well, we kind of come from the same generation of slowing it down and playing the moments.
Yeah.
You know? Like, you really are, you're a great actor who improvises.
Oh, Jimmy, thank you.
Okay. All right, we had another question back here. Yeah.
Every improviser feels burnt out at some point. Do you think it's better to take a break or to just work through it and then just get past that point?
Me personally, sometimes I gotta take a break when I get burned out on something. Like when I get burned out on teaching, it's like, okay, I need a term off. Because it's, you know, I'm not doing it right. I'm too angry at them or whatever. But other people might be different. It might be different for you. I need a break every once in a while. And it's weird. It's like, I need a break from a career where I really only work like 2 days a week. It's like, ah, I need a vacation. And my wife is like looking at me like,
what? Yeah, right here.
Usually in improv, you're with groups or with a lot of people, but that's not always the case with everybody. What do you find that can help you be a better improviser by yourself, or is it listening or observing more, or when you're on your own time?
I think there are some things you could do on your own to get better. I think character work, developing characters, building up your repertoire of characters. I think you have to do that on your own because you'll never get enough time to do that in any class. I think you could get better at like space object work. You'll never have enough time in a class to get good at it. But most of it is ensemble, I think, and ensemble playing skills that it really helps to generate with a regular group of people and develop your own language for give and take a focus and understand how to set people up, you know, learning tendencies and all that stuff. So, yeah. Best done in an ensemble, but there are a couple few things. Gibberish you can get better at on your own.
What kind of students are likely to be successful improvisers?
Here's what I have been telling students recently that are always wondering how to become successful. I tell them that the students and the improvisers that are totally immerse themselves, that are obsessed with it, those are the ones that tend to do well. Like I go to a lot of improv shows and I look around the audience and it's the people that I keep seeing in the audiences, you know, the students that I see that are constantly looking at shows and constantly trying to pick up tips and doing it themselves. I think the best experience is being in a regular performing improv group with an outside eye that can give you gentle feedback.
Have you ever had a student in your class and you're like, this person, they don't get it, they're never going to get it, and then they go on to be successful? Or they're just not clicking with your teaching methods?
Yeah, I mean, I've had students like that. I can usually tell, like, really, really fast how far a student is going to get, don't you think? Haven't you been teaching long enough to, like, you know, like,
how
to watching someone for, like, 10 minutes, you know, what you're going to be able to teach them, you know, what they need. You can see what they've learned, don't you think?
Yeah, I'm curious, what kind of, how are you measuring that? Like, is it just an instinct you have, or is it a certain confidence that the student is putting out there? What is it that you're able to do that so quickly?
I want to call it experience. It's just, I don't know what it is. I can just tell. You can tell. You watch someone improvise for a couple minutes, you'll be able to tell how much training they've had, right?
Right. Oh, really?
Where they're at in their training.
Right, and where they studied.
Yeah.
I can tell Annoyance, I.O.
Yep. Most definitely.
Second City, I can tell. Yep.
Most definitely. And you can see this is what they haven't learned yet. And you can see, you know, after a few more minutes, you can see what they had for breakfast, you know,
right.
If you look really close. Like,
do you ever get intimidated? Because this happens to me sometimes. A really sharp student will come in and have a lot of experience. And I will get intimidated, and it's sometimes it's very hard to teach them because I'm being intimidated by them. Has that ever happened to you?
Yeah. Remember when I was talking to you about being used to being in rooms full of strangers,
uh-huh,
and being able to quickly assess, you know, every room full of 20 people has some, like, characters in it. And you need to recognize right away who is that person that's over this. It's like, who are those students? You need to recognize them right away. You need to recognize the other types, the ones that are there early, that are helping you put the room together.
I never get those.
You never get those? Those are rare.
Yeah. Why is it important to identify those students?
Because you have to teach them differently. You have to get that person that's over all this and knows everything already, and you got to get that person to help you teach these other people. So they feel like they're important, and you've given them a little bit of status, and that gets them interested in the class. People learn a lot when they get to teach it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like that person will realize how much you've actually taught them when you make them teach something to other people. And you're like, yeah, not so easy, is it? You're going to shut up now, aren't you? Anyway.
Great. I got one more question here for you.
To a certain extent, do you think there's at least some part of a good improviser that's just natural talent? That, I mean, you can always, I guess, get better, but there's just some people just have it and some people don't, no matter what.
I used to think that anyone could improvise.
You never did corporate training, did you? You never did corporate training.
That was my theory going into teaching. That was a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
Here's where I'm at now. Anyone who wants to improvise can improvise. How many people can improvise well enough to do it professionally? Very, very few people.
And what do you mean professionally, so people know?
Get paid.
Okay.
To do it. Like, I'm getting paid right now, right?
Yes. We are both. We'll both be able to take off a term after this show.
Sweet.
We had one more question? Yeah.
Yeah, I just was wondering if you had a comment on the current visibility of minority performers.
They're all over the place, man. I'm kind of teasing. But yeah, there are more, and they're loving all the minority improv and sketch groups. This last year I had the opportunity to work with Salsation and Stir Friday Night. Loving all the women improv groups. I think they're stepping up, and I think more people are getting training that allows them to go out on their own and write their own sketches and find their own directors and make up their own forms and find their own place and put up a show. I think, it can get better, and it's going to, but big improvement from when I was starting out.
John Hildreth? Thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you, Jimmy.
What is that? How do you feel about that? I mean, a lot of these are your students.
Yeah,
and they're applauding
you
for for being a teacher. Tell me, how is that different than when you do a show and get applause?
It's a lot more personal because I feel that they know me, you know what I mean? It's like when you're in front of an audience, it's just a bunch of, you know, light blurs in the darkness, and you know you don't know any of these people, and you get their applause, you're like, yeah, this is great, this is great. But, you know, when you know them, it's it means more.
That's great.
Yeah?
Thanks again.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for being such a great audience. I want to thank Carrie on the lights, Ben Caprera, our producer. If you and certainly stay around, we have a wonderful raffle. We're raffling off. I'm going to get this right because I heard the interns are making fun of me because I say Justin Bieber, and it's Justin Bieber, yeah. And they laugh because I think that's dirty, right?
That'd be,
yeah,
I
get it now. We're older, so we're a little slower. So we're it's a singing toothbrush that we're raffling off.
Oh, wow. And,
or a slot in one of my workshops coming on April 15th.
There you go.
You can see, John, you're teaching at Second City here, and any shows we can see you in?
Jam Sandwich, Saturday nights in Donnie's Skybox at 7:30. Performing tomorrow and the 21st. But come see it. All three of those Saturdays.
It's a great, great show. It's teachers and students performing together. So check that out and check us out.
Thanks for listening. I want to thank our guest, John Hildreth, and all the good people at Second City, and as always, my producer, Ben Caprero. For more information on Improv Nerd or on my award-winning classes, The Artist Low Comedy, or to check out my improv blog, go to jimmycarain.com. And please, like us on Facebook, on Improv Nerd. It really helps with my self-esteem. And remember, as always, walk, don't run. Improv Nerd.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.